Welcome to the C Word, the Conservators podcast. Today we're talking about using AI. I'm Jenna Mathiason, an objects conservator based in Carmarthen in Wales.
I'm Fedra Kamadjermou, a conservator of antiquities based in Nicosia, Cyprus.
I'm Solange, a book conservator based in Sheffield, England.
Yay! Welcome to the episode, everyone. This is another technical one. We've done a couple of technical ones before, notably ones on the Raspberry Pi and the Arduino, but this is another technical one that I think we're going to enjoy. To help us explore it, we do have a special guest host with us. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, I'm Louisa Casella. I'm a photograph conservator based in Ithaca, New York.
Welcome, Louisa. And just to give people some context, you've been working on training a ChatGPT version called Craig, the Conservation Restoration AI Generative Tool. And that's why we've invited you on today. You know, just to layer the landscape here, we're all conservators here. We are not AI experts by any stretch of the imagination, but we do all have different perspectives, use cases and things like that. So this is going to be quite a nice little chat, I think, just about what AI is and what we use it for. And I always love starting with a definition. Do we have any definitions around the room or thoughts about what is AI?
So AI is a broad term that defines the science of making machines think like humans. So that means learning from experience, adjust to instructions, and yes, and evolve. And I would add to that that they can take huge amounts of data and sort of digest it and repackage them in a record speed, really fast.
Yeah, it's amazing. So AI stands for artificial intelligence, and it sounds very sci-fi. But yeah, it is sort of having computers learn and solve problems in a human-like manner-ish, or at least to carry out tasks of certain natures.
Well, I guess what's kind of made it quite popular suddenly with ChatGPT arriving on the scene is the fact that it can now communicate with us in kind of everyday language. You know, it doesn't sound like a computer or a robot in the way that it expresses itself.
Yeah, that's true. AI have been around for a while. I'm not going to say the trigger words, actually. I just realized. But some of virtual home assistants and things like that from various companies. I'm not going to set yours off, I promise. So I won't say any of the trigger ones. But, you know, if you have one of those and you ask, usually female name, what's the weather like today? That's an AI, for example.
I find a ChatGPT AI to be extremely polite. It's a very polite kind of human.
It is, for people who are listening and are not familiar with what ChatGPT is, it is essentially a very sophisticated chatbot. I hate the name, ChatGPT. I never remember the right order of the letters. I'm always confused about it. Did I get that right? But that is what it's called. And it's been around since late 2022, I believe, in the format that we can access anyway. It's a mostly free-to-use tool. And yeah, it's a type of AI that's generative, which means that it can generate something. So for it, it's text. And it's a large language model, which means it is trained on a huge amount of text. Like, we cannot comprehend how much text. this is way past what a human can read in a lifetime kind of job, right? Like, it's so much text that it's been trained on. And that's the thing about AI, is they have to be trained on something to learn and to become the tools that we use.
I think that's a perfect segue for Louisa. Can you explain to us how you have used AI, or how you have actually trained AI?
So how I trained the model, first of all, I was very excited when AI came out, and I use GPT, the free version, on my daily tasks. So I use it to rewrite text. It's like a personal secretary to me. If I need to write a letter of recommendation, I ask it to do it, and then I always revise it. But it's like having a really, you know, a free secretary that writes your stuff for you. And it doesn't always work. And that's part of the what's hard for us to learn with interacting with a machine that's unpredictable, is sometimes you get stuck. Sometimes the response is not good. According to my brother, who's the tech who's been helping me with all this, even who created the tool, they're not sure why some glitches can happen. So in any case, he's the one who explained to me what the GPT tool, what large language models are doing, is taking a set of data. The default will be whatever GPT has. So it's like all of Wikipedia up to 2023 or whatever. And they're very quickly pulling that information to you on your terms, on what you're asking. If you get the GPT paid version, you can create your own models. You can train them. So you create as many GPTs as you want and you configure them. And when you configure them, there's two parts of the training. One is the instructions. So that's where you say, be polite, be not polite, talk like the cool kids, talk like, you know, that's part of the instructions is. Mine says you are a streamlined art conservation restoration generative AI tool designed specifically for professional conservators. So by that, we already know that it's not going to give you the, it's going to talk in a sophisticated language for conservators. Your primary function is to assist in sorting the most relevant authoritative information from a curated list of specialized websites within the conservation and cultural heritage field. When tasked with a search, adhere to the following guidelines. So this is where you say what you want it to do. So then I tell it to go, you know, my code, I'm not going to go into it, but essentially it goes to the Conservation Wiki, Getty AT&T, the AIC website, Canadian CCI website. And so all the, you know, and I can add to these and then search results because I want this to be academic and all of us conservatives, we don't trust whatever. We need a source. So I said search results. Always include a link to the search results to facilitate direct access to the information that ensures that professional conservators can quickly review and access the resources identified, and then knowledge based citations. So
you're constraining it to be quite a professional resource as opposed to I got this from a YouTube video where someone cleaned something with rhubarb, you know?
Yes, absolutely. So I give up, but it still goes. So it uses my instructions, but if it can't find things there, it still goes to its default, which is whatever GPT uses. So that's why sometimes it doesn't do what you want. So it also needs a sophisticated user who kind of a little bit understands AI and can push it to say, look again. So the other thing you would do, so this is the instructions, but then you have the knowledge base. So the knowledge base is where you can upload files. So you can, you know, you could potentially download the AIC Wiki entirely and put it there. Right now, there's a limit of how much data it can take. And so you'd have to repackage it smaller. Now, I have not done this. I want to make it very clear. I've not scripted anybody's website because that's where you fall into copyright issues. And I believe that's what's happening with AI at the moment is that Wikipedia or Google are coming after them because you're basically using somebody else's information as your backbone, as your biggest asset.
This is definitely a big problem with large language models in particular, that sometimes we don't know what they've been fed, which sounds like a really strange way of putting it, but basically we don't know what they've been trained on. I think famously comedian Sarah Silverman recently like tried suing one of these companies because she believes that they've put her books into it, for example, which obviously is a huge breach, for example. And these are the sorts of things, like if you don't know what it's been trained on, it could have been trained on copyright breaching things, for example, like just putting someone's book in. This is a particularly big problem in image generating AI. So there are quite a few tools out there like DALL-E and things like that, where you can essentially give an AI a text prompt, for example, draw me a picture drawn in the style of the C Words episode artwork that depicts this or that. It would potentially be able to do that. And sometimes those sort of trained model, like the images they've been trained on, are copyrighted things.
And I think with most technology, the rub really is those ethical considerations are up to each person. So if you can do it, somebody's going to do it. I'm not going to do it because I have my own ethical, but I don't think you can. I mean, I suppose you can legislate, but you can't find it. Repackages all the information. So it's very hard to prove unless you can see the instruction side of things. It's very hard to prove someone has actually done that. So I've not done that and I will not do. And I can go on to explain how beyond this what I'm doing.
But it's interesting to think, because perhaps, just throwing this out there, if someone was to approach you and say, I've got these non-copyright encumbered papers that I've written and I'm allowed to, under the whatever publication guidelines that they've published under, I'm allowed to give these to you to feed into your tool to add to the database, presumably that would be absolutely fine because they are giving you permission. Yeah, so that there's a potential there for sort of a nice sharing where it's like, I'm giving you this information, as opposed to I've scanned in a whole book from Vels and Hoary or something, you know, which is not definitely absolutely not what we should be doing. Yeah.
There's huge scope for a collaborative project for revenue to be created, perhaps for academic journals and such, for allowing their material to be used in this way.
Oh, potentially, yeah. I mean, I think we're not there yet in terms of what sort of agreements people have, but it would be interesting, wouldn't it, if publishers asked people who've maybe written conservation books, for example, would you allow this to happen if you could get some of the royalties or whatever money we get out of it, as long as you would still be paid?
I think it would have to be maybe with grants. That's what where I thought this could go. And that's, I when I started this, and it's still very rustic, honestly, I just want to understand. I like technology and I like evolution. I think this is a brilliant development. And so I think the sooner we jump on using it, the sooner we can make something that's useful. And, you know, conservators don't have money. People who write, conservation scholars don't have any money. So it has to come from, as usual, some kind of public funding or grants, or, you know, that's how I see it.
The sources that you have used so far in training AI, have they been open access? Have you had to ask for permission from authors?
No. So far, I've not uploaded any knowledge other than the instructions, and it's been working quite well. So it basically, it's a Google search kind of a thing that goes to the site, the places I tell it. So I get a response that usually says, you know, Getty says this and ASC Wiki says that. It's very rustic. Even the ASC Wiki, and I'm very involved with the ASC Wiki. I was there, you know, that's kind of my interest in this comes from the ASC Wiki, where I was part of the team that started it in 2008. And I'm a strong believer in pulling information and giving access. And I'm mostly thinking of, I just came back from a training I gave in Cuba. And I'm mostly thinking of more remote places that the internet really is changing the game, because they can access up-to-date information. With AI, you can actually interact in your language. So you can interact with the tool in Spanish, in Italian, in Greek, in Portuguese. So for example, when I was preparing the classes for them, I was interacting in Spanish and I was saying, can you rewrite this for me? Because I gave the class in Spanish. So that's another wonderful thing, is that it's in all these languages. You don't have to worry about the translation.
I have actually noticed when I was using Crake that if I asked a question in English and the same question in Greek, the answer would be basically identical. And when I put the English answer into Google Translate, it gave me the exact same text into Greek that the AI had responded in Greek at the time. So I have a strong belief that it uses Google Translate.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure it does.
Because this means that there's the potential for much quicker knowledge transfer between people who don't speak the same language, ultimately.
Absolutely, yeah.
I am on the fence about AI in general, because I know its huge environmental impact, which
and
I...
The servers.
Yeah, because I do struggle with that side of things, where like it is tremendous. And I think a lot of people are not aware of just like how huge an amount of electricity, raw material, land use, water, how much it actually uses. Because basically, we're interacting with it in the cloud, of course, via our computers or our phones or whatever it is. But you can think of it a bit as if AI lives in these giant data centers. And they're sometimes being built on land where local communities were not particularly happy to discover that a data center was being put. It's using up valuable water resources, and usually they're fueled by fossil fuels, which is not great. You know, there are some astonishing figures, like 3 to 4% of all global emissions are currently data centers, and this is expanding. It's actually more than the aviation industry. So if you think about how many times we're all thinking about not using flights, the fact that we're now all very much using AI in our daily lives and are set to do that much more, it's a huge environmental concern. Now, there are some things that we can do to make all of that much greener. We can figure out better and more efficient ways of running these data centers and making sure that we don't run them like colonial, frankly. You know, like, you know, if we do that a bit better, then...
Because a huge problem is keeping them cool, isn't it? Like,
yes.
So much energy goes into keeping all these units.
And that's a lot of the water usage is water cooling them. Yeah.
I've heard that in some places they're building them underwater, like
yes.
The sea or whatever, where it's cold. But yeah, I mean, but then modern human life is so damaging for the environment. And that's the big problem that we need to work on, like the burning the fossil fuels as like, but if we have, we're investing more in green energy, then.
That goes part of the way. Yeah, it does go part of the way to make that greener. So I think there's hope for it. But I do want to flag it up because I think it's something that museums and also us as conservation professionals should just be aware of, that there is a huge carbon footprint involved with this. I think we need to be aware of it and make informed decisions based on it, offset where we can. But, you know, just straight up, just tell the facts as it is, that it uses a lot of energy. In fact, using ChatGPT is 10 times more energy intense than asking Google for a quick Google search, for example. I can link to a report that was really good in the show notes if you're interested in this sort of thing.
I would love to read that. Yeah, I don't, because sustainability is another one of my passions. And so I'm kind of like, wow.
There's another ethical implication of ChatGPT or these kinds of large data AI, where you don't want your AI to be trained on certain input, like, you know, criminal activity, you know, really horrible videos out there that you just don't want going into your AI, that hateful things. Filtering out that information has to be done by humans. And that kind of work is being outsourced to third world countries, where there are people who have to sit for $3 an hour and be traumatized in order to stop our AI having this in it.
There are some really big implications there for people's well-being and who we're doing this to, etc. And definitely the global south is more affected by these things than the global north. Again, rich countries outsourcing bad stuff to poorer countries. So that is something to be aware of. You know, if we're committing to have more decolonial practices and things, then we should really take that into account when we use these tools and stuff like that. It's just something to be aware of. That being said, I think there are fantastic uses for AI. There are also some where I'm like, you know what, I can go back to writing my own emails. Generally used it to start a draft to my MP the other day. So I was like, I don't know how to do this. I don't talk to MPs on a regular basis. And then I could edit that to be more to my tastes and stuff like that. But it did help. You know, I wouldn't use it for everything. But I also realized that I say that from a point of privilege. Like, I don't have dyslexia. I don't necessarily, even though I'm floundering now, I don't necessarily struggle with finding words, at least not in written format.
I used it to write my health and safety policy.
Nice.
For my studio. And, you know, one for hosting interns, having visitors, you know, various different policies for my studio that I needed to have in place before this intern started with me. And that I only needed to tweak them a bit. It came up with so many things I just wouldn't have thought to include unless I'd looked at lots and lots of other ones. It saved me like potentially 2 days of work.
Nice.
You know,
it is hard to argue with.
Person, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, but for self-employed people, that's a big deal. You know, like that's a huge amount of time that we don't get paid for. You know, like, and I'm sure overworked people in institutions feel exactly the same way, don't get me wrong, but you know.
I actually so ChatGPT became available in 2022, and I was in the middle of my studies, my master's degree in conservation. And I know that students were starting to use it for essay writing, some more heavily than others. Not me, because I have a very specific way of writing and I wouldn't change it for the world. But I do have a story from my mother-in-law, who is a lecturer at a university in the US. And she said that once she received, in 2022, she received an essay which looked very strange compared to other essays that had been written by the same student. And so she went onto ChatGPT and asked, did this student use ChatGPT to write this essay? And ChatGPT responded, yes. So she asked again, how do you know? And it responded, because I wrote it. So ChatGPT will rat you out. So you really need to be careful about that.
That's fascinating.
I know, right?
I didn't think that was possible.
I don't know, though, because it might not. It might just be telling her what it thinks she wants to hear.
This is an interesting point. Large language models are referred to as prediction machines because they sort of are. They are trained on a huge amount of data and but really they're sort of like predictive text. Also, I know that we briefly mentioned glitches. There are some fantastic glitches and they're sometimes called hallucinations. So essentially AI hallucinate things, which sound very plausible. I just love it.
But what I would say is that it's meant for a sophisticated user. You can't take the response as the final product. You know, I've had it respond to previous questions, for example. And sometimes I get frustrated and I just do it myself. But you need to understand you're dealing with a tool. It's a machine. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like when you search for Google, sometimes you don't find what you want. You know, you can go for pages and pages. So nothing in itself is good or bad. This is like, it's a tool. I remember trying to use the internet for the first time and asking, where does it live? Where is it? You know, and now I don't question it. So it's just another tool like that. It's a technology. It's very frightening, the thought of the emissions. I mean, the carbon emissions are an issue in everything that we do in our lives, but it's a genie. It's not going back in the bottle. And so the only way to deal with things like this is to find, you know, better sources of energy. And
but just going back to what you were saying about how it requires a sophisticated user, because when it comes to conservation and asking purely conservation questions, because we got a subscription for Craig Conservation Restoration AI generative tool.
You get a subscription to the whole GPT, not just, I'm not being paid. I called it Craig because I wanted to be like Hal in 2001. Nice. I wanted to be a name. And I came up with a name, of course, using GPT several names. I wanted to have an acronym that was like Hal. So Craig was the closest one.
Perfect.
And so I've tried, you know, I've done asked it some conservation treatment questions, and it has been really helpful and helped me to think through my decisions and various options. And even it's given me step-by-step instructions for a treatment that I was a bit rusty on and kind of wanted to just refresh. But what struck me was that is great for someone like me who trained during a time when this tool wasn't available, because I can determine when it's leading me in the wrong direction. But definitely this tool is going to have an impact on how we, it surely will need to have an impact on how we train people in the future so that they will be able to distinguish still and won't just sort of follow instructions. And also the ethics, because can you program it to have conservation ethics, like if it's
absolutely yes
a treatment?
I have the disclaimer, so, and even when you open the tool it says it's for concern, so it's a bit like at the beginning of the AIC wiki there are people with concern, well, can't anyone just do this? And I mean, anyone can maybe read a surgery book and amputate a foot, you know. I think that, you know, that doesn't get resolved at this level, gets resolved at the level of accreditation, which I've always been a proponent of.
As I was asking specific questions on treatments myself, I would often get responses, very detailed step-by-step responses, but it would tell me to conduct thorough study of the object to look at the deterioration. It would tell me to record everything multiple times, so at multiple points while describing what I needed to do. And it also said that, this specific treatment is quite complicated, so I would advise that you contact an actual conservator. Constantly reminds you that you might not be the person that should be doing that kind of treatment onto an object.
Yes. I remember reading that and going, I'm pretty sure I'm a conservator.
That's that imposter syndrome again.
Yeah, it's like the definition of. Before we had this meeting, I actually asked it to answer what the impact of AI will have on the conservation profession. And some of its responses, it was quite interesting. One of the things it suggested that could a potential use was automated documentation using image recognition. So I guess you'd have like a 3D image and it would be able to just be like, okay, so the media here is like fireball or like blah, blah. But I immediately had an issue with that because so much is sense through even smell. Like I sometimes have to remind myself not to sniff books in front of clients because it looks weird.
So relatable.
Yeah, when you said automated documentation, I immediately thought not of the examination because you have to look at it, but at we do a lot of exams and reports that, I mean, in my last position, they were done as a Word document. I mean, you know, those are things that you don't look forward to doing. So if you can have a tool, I'm not sure when or how AI will do it, but it could program something to kind of, you know, if it's a crayon portrait that needs light bleaching, it could fill out the proposal for you, you know, the first bits of it, and then you can go in and make adjustments to things. But
yeah, like it would be good if you could just talk out loud while you're looking at an object and then it would just turn into a sensible.
I mean, essentially that's just text to speech or like speech to text, isn't it? Like that's
But it would like write the full sentences, you know what I mean?
I was gonna say that we've talked a lot about generative AI so far, but I think maybe my favorite AI is probably the analytical kind, where it's all about pattern recognition and, you know, like seeing patterns that as a teeny wee human, you just can't because you don't have the brain space to look at so many images or so many pieces of text. I think those are the really fascinating applications where stuff can get really interesting.
Yeah, well, that was one of the other suggestions.
Yay! Tell us more.
For predicting deterioration, like say of a collection. So if you have the data of what materials are there and everything, then and environmental conditions. And so it could help a lot with preventive conservation, like, yeah, and dealing with that kind of side of things.
Yeah, I think I've seen people suggest things like looking at just images of pest traps, for example. And rather than you having to count each insect and identifying it, it will say you have a 5% increase of carpet beetle in this area compared to last year or something like that. That will frankly be amazing.
Yes, I would welcome that.
And it would be able to track the life cycle.
Because you would still, you know, as the preventive conservator, you would still have to, you know, like implement the changes and like think about what that means or why that might happen. But you wouldn't necessarily have to sit there with the microscope looking at, you know, 150 pest traps for the next 2 days and then carefully figure out, oh, is that one? Oh, it could be. Oh. But, you know, between image recognition and like a decent database crunch, that could happen a lot quicker.
And the other thing, too, is that we all, as conservators, we know about resources and websites. I mean, people show me new websites I didn't know about all the time. And, you know, and so to have a tool that you say, go to this place and that, you know, it's not like a Google search. You're tailoring it to just a set of places you know that exist.
And honestly, search engines aren't what they used to be. They're not as good anymore. So having a tool like this is hyper-specialist.
Well, it's just there's so much information there that, you know, Google is searching through keywords, through words, and this is searching a different way, concepts. And
I mean, definitely the museum world at least needs some updates because we've been using the same database for decades. There are multiple memes about that. The internet.
And anyone who's ever been in an institution where one database system has to be upgraded to a newer one knows that that is a nightmare because none of the fields match and people have ended up using 15 different words for a cup for the past 20 years. And there, I think there's another like good thing that AI can do for us is just sort of help us with the painful process of just suggesting some changes, for example, not implementing them, you know, running them by a human, because again, we are the experts and yes, it needs to be run by, you know, run through humans. But, you know, just saying, I reckon cups, mugs, they should all be actually lumped under cup. It would just help the database tidying so much.
So do you think there'll be a time when some museum will transfer their database to an AI? Because you could do that, right? You could transfer all that data to an AI, and instead of using the database, you would interact with the AI tool.
I reckon it's only a matter of time before those two things are joined together, if you see what I mean. Like the people who make the databases, I would frankly expect them to say, and we bolted on an AI that just gives you the information in a sensible format. That's only a matter of time, surely. Did it suggest other fun things for you, Solange?
It suggested that there was a potential for AI-enhanced learning for conservation students. So creating simulated learning experiences where you could practice treatments without using a real object. Again, I felt skeptical about that one. I don't think you can learn properly unless there's a little bit of a chance that you could make a genuine mistake that matters.
Yeah.
That is the horrifying truth of our profession, if I've ever heard it.
And so, yeah. But maybe there are other ways in which, yeah, these some kind of simulations, like maybe simulate an emergency situation. Yes.
I have heard people use this for tabletop exercises. So it's creates an emergency situation that your team then has to respond to using their emergency plan. That sounds brilliant to me.
The most value I see is that we as conservators, when we need to look something up, we need to go to 5 books and 10 websites. You know, you need to go to CCI and ICON, you know, JAIC.
And buy a £200 book. Mm.
And if you can get it to do that for you, to go to those websites and just say, you know, just narrow it down. Because oftentimes I sometimes know I've seen something somewhere I can't remember where, so I can ask it. And sometimes I ask again, now look again, because I know it's there. That's the other thing. It's not always... the first answer isn't always just the final word. I've interacted with both just Chat or Craig, and I know there's something about a certain subject, and I'll say, look again and try this, and it will say, oh, I'm sorry, and it finds it for you.
This is the thing where I feel like I'm not a sophisticated user of ChatGPT at the moment.
Yet.
I ask it quite... yeah, I ask it fairly... blunt questions. I might be able to refine it down a little bit. As for my other half, I spent a lot of time with ChatGPT and really knows how to prod it. And it sounds bizarre, but like he can really wrangle it into giving more thorough answers and looking into more sources in a way that kind of blows my mind, because he knows how to talk to it.
Yes, and I think that's key, because it's, again, to the example of the internet. When the internet appeared, I mean, when I went to school before computers, so I was one of those that to bring down the text on Word, I selected the whole thing and clicked enter. You know, you get frustrated. And the first times I used GPT, I'd use it for a little bit, get frustrated and stop. So you kind of have to, you don't have to, but ideally, if you want to use this very powerful tool, you need to learn to use it. Instead of assuming that it's done, it's what's going to be. No, you have to become a better user of it to get what you want out of it. This is for us. It's not for it. It's not for AI. It's for the user.
Here we're back to it being a tool, right? You have to learn to use any tool. It's not like, I mean, yes, I guess you can pick up a hammer and have a go, but ultimately you do know that holding a hammer in a certain way and using it in a certain way will actually yield very different results. But you have to use it to get
there. And humans we're suspicious of innovation, but if this is a tool that's very powerful, so you might as well start learning how to make use of it for your own work.
I think as conservators, we're quite lucky, because for us, I think it will be a tool, a useful tool that we can use. But I think what prompted me to suggest this as a topic for discussion was, I think every profession is now asking, or any worker of any kind will be asking themselves, how is it going to affect my job? Will I have a job? I know people who are losing their jobs because of it. So,
sure.
Yeah. In terms of conservators, though, I've had conservators tell me, oh, robots will replace us soon, all that stuff. But as we said, it's not a person. And I don't think any robot or AI would ever be able to have a delicate touch and to understand pressure of the hand onto a tool or an object. That sounds very unlikely to me. And that fear in our profession, I think, needs to go away, and we should just embrace it and use it as a tool for our documentation and recording, as we've discussed before.
It's actually quite good news for a profession that works with its hands, traditionally is not seen as a high-level profession. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's going to turn the tables, and those kinds of professions are going to become more and more respected.
You know, there's technologies, certain technologies displace other technologies. So, for example, nobody buys a typewriter anymore. So that's unfortunate. I'm sure a lot of typewriting companies were wonderful and they closed down. Nobody buys CDs anymore. So there's a displacement that always happens, digital photography versus film. That's inevitable, you know, and I'm not, you know, but the history of mankind is a history of jobs disappearing. You know, nobody rides a horse and cart anymore. That's not a job anymore. But you have Uber drivers. You know what I mean? It's, I'm not trying to be facetious. It's just, I think this very strong feeling that people are having, it's just a tool, you know, and we have to just be smart about it and not give it a role that it doesn't have. And it's not the robots didn't land in our planet and are taking over. That's not what's happening. It's a tool that was developed. It's a very good tool. And it's users like us that are going to demand how we want it to be, how we want it to, because you can be sure that it's going to continue and evolve. So the sooner we get on it, and us as consumers, we can say, I want it to be more like this. I want it.
Well, it's very important that people like you train it, because you have ethical ideas on where you want to take it and how it can be used within our profession.
I want to throw out a question to the room, and that is, what is the coolest thing you've seen AI used for?
My husband and I first came across ChatGPT. We just playing around, and he asked it to write a rap battle between Carl Jung and Freud. It was pretty good.
Oh, amazing. Oh, that's very hilarious.
Mine is very, it's not very impressive, but I was preparing these classes in Spanish, photograph conservation, and I took big blocks of information from several sources, so from Debbie Norris's blog and from the ASU Wiki, and I made these charts, one-page charts for each process, and they all were pretty good, you know, with state of introduction, process, layers, conservation treatment, all with the same size, all with the same headings. And it took
that's
me,
satisfying.
You know, something that would take me probably a day to do, I was able to do, I don't know, 20 minutes, you know. It's just like, I just had to clean it up.
I think the coolest thing I've seen, that I've seen recently maybe, is that it was another image analyzing tool, but basically they were able to read burnt scrolls from Pompeii.
Oh, yeah.
Not all of it. I think they were, at the time when the article came out, they'd only been able to read like 5 or 10% or something. But they were thinking that if the AI is allowed to like churn away at this for a bit, they could read as much as 90% of it. You cannot unwrap them. They were CT scanned so that you could see each layer, but human eyes just couldn't make out what it was saying. But the AI was able to read essentially brand new material from a very long time ago and tell us loads of things about their philosophy and what they enjoyed in life and something about the color purple. I can't remember what it was now, but I really liked it. It was not at all done by heritage people. There was a prize money pot attached to this project where they were hoping that someone with AI knowledge could create something that would look at these images. And it was three students, a PhD student, a robotics student, and a SpaceX intern who just sort of went, how hard can this be? And I thought that was really brilliant from a, you know, historical point of view.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of preservation as well, not having to unscroll the scrolls is...
Yeah, exactly. Which will not work.
Yeah. I wanted to discuss is the difference between ChatGPT and Craig. So I don't know if you've tried that, but I was asking the same questions to ChatGPT and to Craig to see the difference in the answers. And as I've mentioned before, Craig was much more ethical and reminding people that they should seek the advice of a conservator and they should record everything, whereas ChatGPT wasn't doing so necessarily. And then Craig was much more structured as well. So when I was asking for sources, ChatGPT just gave me a list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whereas Craig was giving me books and then journals and then online sources. And another thing that I noticed with language, every time I would ask a question about a specific material, for example, and why they decided to give me that specific material as a solution to use for treatments, ChatGPT wasn't necessarily giving me a source for that, whereas Craig did. And also when I asked Craig to give me sources in other languages than English, it gave me sources in French, Italian, Spanish, and German. Whereas for some reason, ChatGPT would only give me English and German sources. I don't know. Did you try any of that?
I find that so funny because it didn't even occur to me to like check if it could do Swedish. I just assumed no. Funny.
You should do the same experiment with Google Translate to see if it uses Google Translate.
Yeah, I think I have to give it a go.
It's kind of fun.
Hey all, get ready for a video interview with Professor Robert Erdman, professor at the University of Amsterdam and senior scientist at the Rijk Museum. Tune into our YouTube channel in the next few days to find out how Professor Erdman has used AI in understanding, reconstructing, and preserving Rembrandt's iconic The Night Watch. Make sure to follow us on YouTube and all other social media platforms to catch the release of this fascinating interview.
So today, Fedra and I are reviewing together a lecture that we both attended online called AI, Art and Authenticity. And the lecture was given by Nicholas Esto.
He is none other than the author or one of the authors of the Pigment Compendium, which is a book in every single desk of paintings and wall paintings conservator, right next to the microscope, of course.
So it was all about how AI can or could be used to determine authorship of paintings. And it looked at a number of models that have been developed and comparing their efficacy.
You know, when he began with probabilities, it went right above my head. I mean, I understand the concept of probabilities, but maths was never my favorite subject. Yeah.
It was a bit like a philosophy lecture, you know, like maths and philosophy or something.
That's
maths,
right.
Philosophy 101. I think it was pretty high level for me.
I guess it was very art historical rather than conservation. Yeah.
But I guess what I took away was my surprise at how differently AI sees pictures. It's not like the way a human looks at a picture, which is obvious, but I just hadn't thought about it. In order to create an AI model that can usefully help us, you have to understand what information to put in to train it with in order to get results.
No, I agree with you. I mean, one of the examples that he mentioned was a painting by Raphael that two different AI platforms had completely different results over. So one of the AI that was trained to recognize Raphael painting techniques on the face of painted subjects, it would be 98% accurately a Raphael painting, whereas a different AI-trained study, I think, had a percentage of 86% that it was not a Raphael painting. So I think it really depends on who trains the AI and what type of imagery they concentrate on and the depth of the imagery. So is it just the physical aspect of it, the imagery itself? Is it the brush strokes? Is it the color scheme?
And the way that it's viewing brush strokes is so different from how a human does.
Yeah.
There's all this, a lot of background going on in how we perceive things, whereas the computer is looking at it just in a completely different way. Like, it's hard to explain, I guess.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
The data of the thickness of the line rather than the overall impression of the thickness of the line, I guess. But so he was saying that if you need to train it using images that are very, very similar, but not attributable. So rather than putting lots of not Raphaels, that are obviously not Raphaels, and then Raphaels. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work so well as having training it using pictures that almost look like Raphaels.
Yeah. I mean, do you believe that AI will eventually be a reliable tool for such research yourself?
I think that in terms of understanding the data and being able to sift through a lot of that, I think it could help as an aid.
Mm-hmm. I asked ChatGPT.
Mm.
I asked ChatGPT, do you think AI will ever be able to authenticate painters?
Yeah.
And the response was, AI has already shown impressive capabilities in analyzing and authenticating artworks, primarily through techniques like machine learning and image recognition.
Yeah.
These systems can scrutinize various aspects of a painting, such as brush strokes, pigments used, canvas types, and even compare them to known works by the artist. However, authentication often relies on more than just technical analysis. It requires historical context, expert opinion, and sometimes even provenance research. While AI can contribute significantly to the process, the final decision may still involve human expertise. So while AI can be a powerful tool in authenticating painters, it is likely to be part of a collaborative effort with human experts rather than a standalone solution. So AI itself is promoting a collaborative study with...
I can't imagine it being possible without it being collaborative with a human.
Yeah.
One thing that was mentioned in the lecture was that, you know, of course, humans are quite subjective. So an expert be wrong when they look at a painting and they have a gut instinct, whereas the AI will just look at it objectively. And that can be helpful if you can really get the image recognition down, you know, secure that. Another thing that was mentioned was complications caused by condition. So like darkening, aged varnish.
I mean, definitely the paintings that we have today and those paintings that are currently analyzed by AI have been aged.
Mm.
Therefore, they have been altered. Exactly. Pigments have been altered. Deterioration processes have changed the chemical.
Yeah.
I think...
and perhaps that's another way... A way in which the collaboration between the AI and the human is necessary, because the human will say, have you considered that it's dark because of this and that?
Yeah.
The eye's in the right pigment or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. No, I guess we'll have to see what happens in the next decade.
Yeah.
I think that's really all we can say from it. And I think that's what this lecture was concluding.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying the C Word and would like to support our work, then please consider becoming one of our patrons. For as little as $1 per month, you can help us keep our episodes online and more of them coming. If supporting us sounds like something you'd like to do, then head over to patreon.com/thecword and join our bunch of absolute champions. Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and you've been listening to Solange, Fedra, Louisa, and me, Jenny. Join us next time for an episode about conserving musical instruments. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show, find us on social media, or email us on thecwordpodcast@gmail.com. The intro and outro music is Spring by Didi Music, used under Creative Commons Attribution License. This has been a Wooden Dice production.